We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Chase Taylor. He's a global macro strategist and editor at Pinecone Macro Research. Thanks for joining me again today, Chase.
Yeah, you bet, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. And you know, the last time you and I spoke, one of the most interesting things that I remember about that conversation was your insight about China wanting to kick the Bitcoin miners out because of the amount of energy that they consume. So a big theme within your work recently is the importance of fossil fuels and really energy. Is this too much of a consensus trade at this point, do you think?
Yes, this is really interesting. I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know Harris Kupperman, better known as Cuppy, and him and I have kind of been debating this a little bit because in my April monthly letter, I kind of warned against commodities, basically just saying, hey, like I think global recession is going to punish them. Even though we have supply issues and essentially all of them, we could have a pretty big pullback. And I thought that could happen to oil as well, even though it didn't seem like it was possible even when I was writing it. But the funny thing is, I think it's a consensus trade from sort of a narrative basis and the way people are thinking about it. If you just look at, you know, headlines from mainstream media, it's very pro, like oil is going up. You're seeing price targets above 300 thrown around every day now. So from that standpoint, it is. But if you just kind of look at the raw positioning data, whether it's in futures or even the ETFs, you know, their share counts, it's not consensus from an actual positioning standpoint. So it's a very interesting kind of dichotomy. I've kind of viewed it as consensus for my own trading purposes. Like, it feels like I don't know anyone that's short. I don't know anyone that's bearish. For me, that was kind of enough. To short. I didn't get short oil or anything like that. I didn't sell, you know, everything I owned, but I got rid of all my futures and I sold a little more than a third of my equities just to get out of the way of exactly what we're having right now. So it's a weird time for oil. It's kind of a yes and no when it comes to consensus.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, going through that idea of consensus, one of your recent newsletters, you put the collage from 2 years ago of everybody being bearish oil, right?
Exactly. It's funny you mention that because I still remember making that, at least it was a couple of years ago. And as I was making it, I remember telling myself, like, there's going to come a time when this is all going to flip and you're not going to want to get out of your position. You know, but you kind of know in markets, you after you learn the painful lessons that you will have to sell things when they're really dear to you, whenever it looks like it is going to go above 300, that's when it's time to at least take, you know, substantial profits. And that's exactly what we're getting. And I easily could have made the reverse collage of all the, you know, we don't have enough, all the warnings from OPEC, you know, we don't have enough refining capacity. We don't have this, we don't have that. It's the same thing as I wrote back then. And the funny part is, you know, Jim Cramer was saying it was a perma short back then. That's part of my collage. And, you know, the last few months, he's been a huge oil cheerleader. So it's kind of perfectly encapsulates the, you know, 180 degree narrative reversal.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's all those Twitter accounts that do the reverse Jim Cramer, right?
Yeah, that's pretty good way of operating usually.
So how do you view the balance between the demand destruction because of the relative high price of oil versus the need for it in everyday processes of modern life? Are the scales, you know, starting to tip away from the higher prices or just, you know, sustaining this current level at very least?
Yeah, this is like a very difficult thing to pin down is what I've found. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you do get demand destruction during recessionary times. And we already have seen, even in the US, we've seen, you know, a decent amount, not a lot, but a decent amount of demand destruction. But at the same time, it is a very sticky commodity. Like, we all have to use it. It's very difficult to get around using oil, you know, in our daily lives. So there's only so much demand you can really destroy at the end of the day. But I think what people forget is even when supply and demand is in your favor in a commodity, if you go into a global recessionary environment, especially one where, you know, the dollar is just in complete like liftoff mode, like you know, oil still can get hit. Even if it doesn't make sense that it's getting hit, it can get hit. Mm-hmm. Or you look at something like copper, like the supply and demand picture for copper in 5 years is really bullish, but copper is getting smoked. And that's how markets work. And I think a lot of people that love commodities easily lose sight of the fact that commodities get hurt during recessions. It's just how, you know, it's just the way it works. But yeah, to your point though, we have demand destruction. We're going to continue to have demand destruction. But if you just kind of look at the barrel counting numbers and how much demand is being destroyed, and then you look at the price changes, it's not going to make sense. You won't be like, wow, yeah, that makes sense that we fell, you know, $40 on oil. It's not going to make sense. But that is still how it works, in my opinion. You know, we all look at that supply side. That's been kind of everyone's focus. But demand will go down. And if you've priced in demand to keep rising 1-2%, and then all of a sudden it's down 1-2%, like just that delta is a big deal for price.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, China has issued now higher oil import quotas for its refineries, as you pointed out recently on your Substack. Often on the show, I've pointed out that China, in my opinion, in some ways is a great example of an economy that has the long-term foresight to see what it needs and possibly where really the puck is headed, as they've been, let's say, buying gold for many years and now increasing oil import quotas. So does this signal to you that the oil trade is far from over as well?
Yeah, it's like an interesting way of looking at it. In some ways, that's great for oil, but in other ways, you know, it's showing you that we're going to close that supply gap on products. Well, at least possibly. Mm-hmm. To me, it makes sense for China to start exporting gasoline and diesel like crazy. They have the spare capacity to do it. The price, you know, arbitrage is phenomenal. There's a lot of other benefits for them to do that. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, that's that much more oil that they're going to have to consume. Now, they're going to get it cheaply, though. They're going to get it, you know, at a discount from Russia. They kind of have Russia and Iran bidding lower and lower to try and get them to take their oil. So they can get a lot of cheap oil, and then they can turn around and sell it to the West as refined products for, you know, $40 to $60 spread. So traditionally, they don't do a lot of product exports. But now with, you know, demand being so low within China and them obviously needing the dollars, them needing, you know, their Western consumers to not have inflation wipe them out so they can keep exporting manufacturing goods. There's just so many incentives then to be able to get some trade concessions from the US. Because obviously I think President Biden needs lower gasoline prices more than he needs anything right now. And China can really help him get that. So many incentives line up for them to, yeah, start buying all the oil they can get their hands on and refining it and turning it around.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you point out the difference really between crude costs and refined products like gasoline and diesel, and how each of those, you know, really inputs into, let's say, the inflation picture. So if you could, you know, break that apart for us, the difference between crude and the refined products that we're paying for at the pump.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, whenever they're looking at, you know, oil and inflation and the impact, they really think about oil. Or when they think about demand destruction, they're thinking about oil. You'll see I've seen a lot of people on Twitter saying, "No, we're not going to get demand destruction with oil at 120, 130, 140." That you know, that in a lot of ways is true. But when you have gasoline and diesel at all time highs, like, well, you will get some demand destruction because, you know, when you go down to the local Exxon gas station, you don't buy crude oil, you buy gasoline. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important. And North America has lost a lot of refining capacity in the last couple of years, and Europe as well. So in the West, we have a way of, if something's happening in the West, we extrapolate it and just kind of figure it's happening everywhere. And I think we've seen a lot of fear about refining capacity globally, whenever the reality is we have a lot in Asia, and it's been growing rapidly in Asia. So, and we're going to get giant refineries coming online in Africa as well, and then the Middle East in the next couple of years. So the refining capacity is going to be there. It's just not going to be in the West. But, you know, currently the crack spread's at 46. So roughly the proxy for refining margins. So the difference between the input and the output, which is significant, you know, normally that's like 20-ish. And now it's, you know, more than double that. It was at 60 at one point. So that shows you how tight those product markets are. And it shows you that it's that we've really struggled to increase the throughput enough to kind of calm that down. But that's where I think what we'll see is the export quotas from China go up. We may even see those oil import quotas keep rising in China. And then that should absolutely crush refining margins back down to, at, I don't know, call it 30 some point later this year, which really takes the heat out of you know what we pay at the pump, which really takes the heat out of a lot of inflation numbers later in the year too, I think.
Yeah, because it's such a big piece of inflation, and let's say every day input cost to everything that we need, right?
Yeah, exactly. Whether it's, you know, the cost of shipping things across the ocean, or you know, putting them on a truck or putting them on a train, it kind of seeps into everything in life, and packaging costs, you know, for even for groceries, like you name it. So if you can get that to kind of calm down the rest of the year, which obviously it's calming down now. I mean, gasoline futures are down 8% today. So, and have gone essentially straight down and all ever since the beginning of June. So I would say the next inflation print's going to come off a little cooler than people expect, but only a little bit, I would assume. And then, but the next one after that, so July's numbers that we'll get in August, I think those could be a pretty significant surprise to the downside.
So is that really due to the Fed's posturing here? And are they going to, do you think, claim that as a victory?
I mean, I think they would probably claim it as a victory. I think they can claim, you know, a lot of the kind of maybe the demand side of the overall economy. But I think what they're doing has a lot more to do with like goods prices. Whenever they break the labor market, that'll help with services inflation, as well as all the overheated housing. They're definitely cooling that off, which is eventually going to help. More like Q4 is when you'll mm-hmm. see services inflation and housing inflation kind of calm down. But really, I don't think what they're doing is having a major impact on oil and gas outside of maybe just them pumping the dollar up is putting pressure. Mm-hmm.
So you wrote that April was one of your most bearish monthlies that you've ever written. Is this because everything is so dependent on the Fed at this point and their actions of raising rates and running off their balance sheet?
Yeah, it's honestly a very, very simple, you know, thesis that I put together for that piece. And it's the most bearish I've ever been, for sure. You know, we've had the Fed put just kind of in our pocket for, you know, really the last 20, 25 years. You just kind of knew if the markets got in trouble, then they were going to help. But it became obvious that had flipped. That the enemy of the Fed was higher stock prices. They literally needed asset prices to go down to help them kind of become the pipeline for their policy to carry through markets and to cause pain. And whenever they made that clear, it just made no sense to have a lot of risk on anymore. You had to wait until markets broke, and then the markets breaking broke the economy, and then eventually the economy breaking, you know, kind of breaks the Fed, and they can back off and at least, you know, pause. And I think we're a lot closer to that than a lot of folks probably think at this point. I think a lot of the data on, you know, kind of beneath the surface, a lot of leading indicators are very bad right now. The, you know, you kind of just look at basic consumption numbers, especially because they're nominal. The economy looks kind of decent, and I think that's why, you know, your average academic or Wall Street economist hasn't figured out that we're in a recession, because they're staring at nominal consumption numbers that look pretty good. But of course they do, you know, but real incomes are going down, and they're going down fast. People have largely used up their savings, especially the kind of like lower income quartile. So moving forward, I just don't see where, you know, the growth is going to come from until we're able to bottom out and have the Fed kind of reverse course. But even that, I think what a lot of people are going to expect is that what we normally get, where the Fed just slashes to zero, does a ton of QE, and everything, you know, it's just happy times again. But if inflation's still, you know, 3.5-4%, something like that, which is very possible, especially, you know, in the next 18 months, you know, the Fed probably can't just slash to zero. They've gotten up to 2-2.5%. They just have to stick there and just kind of let the economy have a slow, you know, malaise grind higher, you know, or at least bottom out at 1% growth or something like that. So I think a lot of people are going to get too excited to go buy all the FANGs again, stuff like that, all that, you know, kind of long duration assets when the reality is that may not be, still may not be where you want to go. You know, things like value and commodities, you know, after they all, you know, finish getting smashed right now, I think can kind of pick back up. Mm-hmm.
So is it possible, Chase, do you think that we actually get the Fed to actually reverse course and come back in, or kind of to your point, what you were saying, do you think that we could see them just kind of stick here and play it out?
At the moment, I kind of favor the latter. If you think about how hawkish they've been for the last 6 months, mm-hmm. where you have the most dovish members of FOMC quoting Volcker on a regular basis, they're kind of on a warpath right now. So it's a super tanker that's going to take some time to turn around to go back to being like actually dovish. Mm-hmm. And can they be like really dovish, you know, with inflation sliding back down at like 7, then 6, then 5? I don't think so. But I think a firm pause they can do. I think they can even do that next month or even later this month if data comes in bad enough. Mm-hmm. But that's about as far as they're going to be able to go. So let's say like later this month they do another 50 or 75 basis points. We're already in a very, very bad spot with the economy. So I want to say we're at a spot with credit spreads where they've never raised in history. And a 314 research had a thing out showing 93% of rate hikes in history have happened with credit spreads at 4.5% or less, I think it was. And we're closing in on 6% on credit spreads right now. So, and that's not a 25 basis point hike we're talking about. We're talking about 75 basis point hike, you know, into 6% potentially on credit spreads. So the economy's telling you like, hey, this is bad. Like this is weakening fast, mm-hmm. and we may still do that. So I'm thinking if they hike into that environment where, in my opinion, we're already in a recession. That's been my opinion for a while, but you know, if you hike into that, the damage that's probably going to do, and they're going to ignore it probably until they see it hit the labor market, which as we all know, is like the most lagging indicator you can get. But for whatever reason, the Fed likes to stare at it and pretend it's leading. Mm-hmm. So whenever the labor market breaks, that's when the Fed can actually calm down, pause. Now, if the labor market collapses and all of a sudden you have 10% unemployment and you kind of have a spiral that's going the opposite direction of the way that they think the spiral is going today, then yeah, then you can see cuts. You know, if GDP grows -3% or something, 4%, and you know job losses are really piling up, you're getting a lot. You're getting evictions and foreclosures, and you know you kind of see that doom loop firing up. Then all of a sudden we can get that cut back to zero moment. But and obviously in that environment, you're not going to have 5% inflation, 4% inflation. It will go back down all the way.
So really the labor market piece that you're talking about is mostly looking at jobs and job losses, just to kind of clarify that for those that might not understand.
Yeah. So I think you can look at it, you know, from a kind of the basic unemployment rate number, or you mm-hmm. can kind of look at it just from a incremental change of something like, you know, jobless claims and kind of where we're at on that. But from my experience, what the markets look at the most and what the Fed looks at the most is what we have coming up this Friday, the actual jobs report. Most people pay limited attention to kind of the JOLTS numbers and stuff like that. But and for whatever reason, the Fed is really, you know, really focused on the job openings data. I think there's a lot of missing signal in that data personally, but again, like they're clearly staring at it. So if you get job openings all of a sudden coming down quickly and job losses, that ratio will just kind of collapse. And they've been really afraid of that ratio the last few months. So mm-hmm. yeah, there's kind of, I guess you could say there's a lot of labor data that is worth looking at and we know that they're looking at. But at the same time, just kind of the basic, those jobs Fridays are the most important. So if you're gonna look at one thing, that should be it. And we have one coming up this coming week. So that'll be a big number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course we're speaking on the morning of July 5th here. So just to give us some context for that. So if the Fed does go, let's say, too far and really sees a collapse and reverses course, considering the lesson that some investors learned from March 2020, do you think that they'll be too quick to jump back into the markets, you know, extremely aggressively if the Fed does pivot?
So I would say if it's a slow pivot or it's a pause for 2 or 3 mm-hmm. months, then the answer is yes. But But if they full blown pivot, you know, if they do go back to zero and they fire up the QE machine all the way back up, then the wrong thing to do would be to not do that. The right lesson there would be do the same thing you should have done in March of 2020, because that will be the answer. Liquidity makes this stuff go. So if they open the taps again, a lot of stuff's going to go back up. Now that doesn't mean, you know, a lot of the bubbles that went nuts are going to go all the way back up the way they did, but that liquidity will find a home. And oftentimes liquidity finds dumb homes. So it may happen again.
Where is the demand destruction that they're trying to create to fight inflation working best, in your opinion?
At the moment, it's working best in housing. That's an area that I think is weakening faster and with more amplitude than people realize at the moment. If you look at especially new home supply, I mean, it is flying off. It is just going off the map. Existing hasn't caught up yet, but I think it will. And a lot of the kind of real-time data I look at, just indicators, is showing like that's starting to move quickly. You're seeing price drops like rapidly enter the market, which, you know, obviously we didn't see 2020, 2021. That was just not a thing. You had to go Hunger Games to get a house. We bought one here in DC in 2021, and it was crazy. You had to be way above asking. You couldn't even imagine trying to get an inspection. You would just lose the house instantly. And now all of a sudden that a lot of that's reversing. You're seeing price cuts instead of, you know, people taking above asking price. Inspections are coming back. You're getting a little bit less of the cash buyers, you know, just snatching everything up. And you're seeing a lot of people that think they can buy a house and they're getting out in the market. And then, you know, their mortgage broker comes back to them and says, yeah, here's rates. Here's what you can buy. And they have to go back to their apartment because the rates have basically doubled, you know, mortgage payments in the last, you know, year. So it's significant what higher rates do, especially when they move that fast to the housing market. So I think inventory is going to continue to build, and I think they're going to surprise to the upside a lot. Now with that said, you know, rates are already backing off because rates kind of smell the recession and smell the Fed pivot. So this could be a kind of a quick, you know, short, painful period for housing that kind of bottoms out quicker than you would think, just because rates are already kind of going back down. Mm-hmm. So if rates are on the escalator down right now, then this can be kind of a quicker thing. But if, you know, if they're going to do 75 basis points more in July and, you know, some just enough data comes through, like, okay, to where they think they're still doing the right thing and they kind of keep pressing into like August, September, I don't think it's possible, but if that does happen, it just does that much more damage to housing. But that's an area where I think the demand destruction is real. We see 15%, I think it is, of renters are behind on their rent right now. So you can see a situation where, I mean, we haven't had foreclosures in this market in years at this point. We haven't had a lot of people getting kicked out of their apartments, you know, in years, because for one thing, during COVID, you couldn't. Mm-hmm. So I think you can start seeing some of those dislocations to where vacancy rates for rentals goes higher, as well as, you know, a lot more supply on the market and housing, and just the supply side of housing in general. We have just an enormous like wave of building that's going to come through the pipeline. I don't think a lot of people realize when it comes to homes under construction, you can combine multifamily and single family. It's never been higher in history. If you look at the stuff that's permitted but hasn't started, you know, it's not under construction left yet. That stuff's the highest in history. So the pipeline of incoming supply is huge, and it happened right when we hit a recession. So that's a bad combo for housing. So I think we're actually going to see price declines. I think we'll see year-over-year declines in home prices. Obviously, it's been like plus 20%, so it's going to take a little time before we're negative, but I think it'll happen. And more importantly, for the economy and for what the Fed's looking at, rent prices, they're still like double digits positive as well. They're up in the teens right now, if you look at the real data, not the way they measure it. But I think that, again, when it comes to the fourth quarter, I think year-over-year-wise, that stuff will be negative. And that allows for a lot of that housing inflation to kind of come out of the numbers in Q4.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that'll be, you know, really a broad theme that'll play out across the country, that housing slide, not necessarily a crash like we saw in 08, contrasted by, let's say, pockets like Florida, for example? Do you think that there are places that could remain high and growing?
Yeah, I do think that's possible. I think everywhere will feel some pain just because the macro on this is so strong. But at the end of the day, like there is a lot of local, you know, when it comes to real estate. So when people are leaving that, you know, high tax states to go to the low tax states, and especially if it's an area that's geographically constrained where you can only build so much, then yeah, you can have some pockets of strength. I think a lot of the equities for even that are stronger in those areas of strength will still get beat up because everyone's just going to sell the ETFs that hold them all. But that will end up creating some opportunities. You know, if you know some builders that are in key regions where job growth is going to be fine because it's, you know, it's not all tech jobs and stuff, then there's going to be some great opportunities. And to be fair, like if you look at home building, it's gotten hit so hard lately, the last, you know, few days, maybe a couple of weeks, it's kind of been a relative winner. It's kind of showing some relative strength, which it should. I mean, with, you know, rates finally kind of peaking out and showing some weakness, that should be happening. And it is. So, you know, I think this is more important from a macro standpoint than it is sort of a trade standpoint. The home building short trade is largely behind us at this point. But that doesn't mean we can't still have a lot of pain and you know, a lot more inventory builds and stuff like that in the space, because I think we will. But from the trade standpoint, a lot of times these trades, they run ahead of what's actually going on in the market. So for all we know, all of it had already been priced into housing. Mm-hmm.
And maybe a good indicator of what you're talking about is lumber costs, let's say. They've fallen off a cliff. So how does that play into your cycle analysis of the housing market, Chase?
Yeah, just in general, lumber is fun for cycle analysis. It is very, very volatile. It will let you know how housing and the economy is doing at any given moment. Mm-hmm. It you know, kind of overshoots and undershoots, but it'll let you know. So it's kind of funny. You can argue that lumber two ways. You can say, hey, lumber's doing pretty decent here lately. But then you can also argue, you know, that it's down, what, I don't know, like 70% off its high. So it's kind of a tricky one. Mm-hmm. I don't like lumber or building at the moment for no other reason than we already have so much in the pipeline and demand's about to get hit. But at the same time, but this also depends on time frames here, because if you just look at the next 10, 15 years, there is structural demand for housing that needs to be met. We have underbuilt, you know, for really 20 years, 15 years. So that's all going to be there. But at the same time, it just might be a, you know, an ugly year to get to the good times of the next 10, 15 years. That's kind of the way I see it. So really long-term investors, you know, builders or even, you know, lumber and companies and things like that, they can make sense. But you know, it's just one of those, the short-term pain can be significant. But what I will add to that is something I always have in my portfolio is timber. I think it's a great thing to just always have in your portfolio, because the land value typically is always going up. And then obviously the value of the wood is typically always going up. And anyone that gets Amazon boxes knows the demand for wood's high because that's what it's made out of. So, I think it's a great diversifier and to be, you know, a piece of any long-term portfolio, tends to move with lumber a good bit, but, that's like one of many real assets I like to always have a little bit of. Mm-hmm.
So you just said something that kind of struck me here of, you know, maybe a year or two of short-term pain before the good times of the next 10 or 15. Do you mean that specifically about the housing market or let's say the US economy in general?
Yeah, more for the housing market.
Okay.
for the U.S. economy, for it to do really well, it kind of needs inflation. It needs fiscal stimulus, a lot of it, and it needs kind of an inflationary backdrop to kind of run hot. But what I think we just learned in the last couple of years is no one wants that. Like no one has the stomach for it, especially mm-hmm. politically. So I think it's going to be a while before we get. And a lot of people think we're going to get, you know, big stimulus checks again in no time. And to me, that has become so politically just radioactive that I struggle to see it happening soon. And because I struggle to see that happening soon, I struggle to see above trend growth again soon. Mm-hmm.
So because so much of this inflation is really cost push inflation, could we see it return very quickly once the Fed comes back with a more dovish tone or starts to pivot from the current tightening monetary policy?
So I think yes. Not to the same scale. I don't think we're gonna have 8-9% inflation again, but but I struggle to see most of the commodity space going back really low again. Just because supply is so tight, it's so bad. So I do think you could see a situation where it comes back now. Do I expect to see goods inflation really high or services inflation really high or rent inflation really high? I don't. I think most of that goes away and it doesn't come back until we have significant fiscal stimulus again. But the food and energy prices, especially energy prices, that's something where I think we're kind of in this problem for a few years, because we, despite what's been happening in oil, going from negative to 130, within a couple of years, we still just don't see the investment. And if you're not going to get the investment, you're not going to get the production in the future. So until you see a massive explosion of CapEx globally in the oil and gas space, and we are seeing some in gas, I should say, but in oil specifically, we're still not. And until we get that, until we have policymakers taking energy security and just energy policy in general more seriously, that it's always going to be looming to at least keep inflation, above that 2% target. I the way I personally see it is the old 1.5 to 2.5-ish kind of regime we were in for inflation. I just see it shifting up about 100 basis points to where you're kind of more like 2 to 3, 2.5 to 3.5% inflation is kind of like the new normal we're going to get for the next few years. And really, I think that there's a lot of structural dynamics behind that, not just, this kind of oil input, but I'm not a huge deglobalization person, but we're going to get a little bit more friendshoring and reshoring. We're going to get supply chains out of the less friendly countries. This is the way we view it. That is by itself is inflationary. I know most people think demographics are deflationary. I think they're inflationary. So I think there's a kind of a lot of the big, prime movers of inflation are shifting from just inherently disinflationary to inherently inflationary. So I just think the new number is more like 3 than 2 at the end of the day, the way it, kind of all comes out in the wash. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we'll have short-term spikes, I think, to like more like 4 or 5, and spikes down to, like 1.5, 2 during recessions instead of, 0 or negative. That's kind of the way I see it working out, which is going to, make investing difficult. It's going to, and those sound like small numbers to say, 1% different, but for investing, allocations, that is a major difference on where you should be putting money in, and where you should avoid. So I think it, if some people are out there listening to this, they're like, nah, we're gonna stay more like 10%. All I would say is if you think, that 1% change I'm talking about becoming that the new difference, just understand that still has a significant impact on portfolios and just capital allocation in general.
Yeah, because it's almost like the old way of signaling where capital should be allocated is kind of broken, right?
It absolutely is broken. And that, it's funny you say that, because that in itself is inflationary. Mm-hmm. Just the share price of these oil companies being so low, that in itself is inflationary, because that tells them it's a signal not to invest for them. It's a signal to just go buy back some more shares, or, just go buy a different, another competitor, like whatever it is, mm-hmm. but do anything other than put money in the ground, because it's not worth it. So until you have like a real re-rating of commodity producing equities, you're not going to get investment and you're not going to get production. And even with this really great run that the commodity stocks have had, like it was not near enough to get them to do what needs to be done from a production standpoint. And a lot of that's indexation. A lot of it's the ESG kind of push, the way, most of your institutional money just left, like just have nothing to do with fossil fuels anymore. So all that kind of combines to create no investment and, by definition, a lot of inflation. Mm-hmm.
Something that you mentioned there that I want to dig into a little bit more was that the demographics could be inflationary. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people see it and like, well, you know, older people kind of consume a little less. So that means less growth. That means less inflation. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, you know, older people, they have been the providers of capital. They have been one of the reasons that capital has been so inexpensive. And we got really used to that. And so whenever they retire, they want their capital back. And in my experience, a lot of older folks don't just sit around a two-bedroom house and do nothing all day. A lot of them travel. A lot of them, you know, they spend a lot of money. So I don't even necessarily believe that side of it as much as other people do. But whenever the holders of the capital want their capital back, the cost of capital goes higher. And when the cost of capital goes higher, that inherently is inflationary. That this is a higher hurdle rate. So it's more difficult to hand out capital for destructive, you know, capital wasting, you know, type of investments. So I think this is an area where, you know, a lot of these like kind of long duration, frothy tech companies that have, you know, gotten hammered over the last year. That's another reason I think they kind of struggle to come all the way back the way a lot of people will suspect they will, because capital is still not going to be as cheap as they need it to not grow. Mm-hmm. The smartest venture capitalists out there are the ones that care about their companies having at least some cash flow. Having cash flow was the worst thing you could do for the last decade if you're a tech startup. But I think in the future, you're going to have to do both. You're going to have to grow, but while you make money, you know, and that's just an enormous regime shift. But yeah, that's the biggest thing. It's just that the fact that capital providers want their money back, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm.
I was listening to Quote the Raven podcast the other day, and they were making the point that the baby boomers, you know, giving their kids some money as well, or if they're dying, that inheritance that comes to the younger generations is also going to be inflationary, because they're going to be spending that on not necessarily wants, but also needs, just paying their bills and maybe getting a house. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that will be a significant driver for like household formation and like durable goods to be, you know, kind of make a comeback eventually. Mm-hmm. You know, millennials are already the biggest, you know, generation, and most of us are capital poor. So, you know, whenever the boomers kind of like do that handover, it will be stimulative for the economy. It will be inflationary. But you know, if you all of a sudden have trillions of dollars go from capital to consumption, you know, that's kind of a double whammy of an inflationary impulse. Now, mm-hmm. again, I don't think that means we just have 8% inflation for the next, you know, 10, 20 years, but I do think the baseline just has to be higher. I think the deflationist view of the world, and you know, in fact, just, oh, we're digitalizing stuff and people are getting old. So, you know, inflation's going to be, you know, 1%, and we'll be able to have zero interest rate policy for the next forever. Like, just, that's just a pipe dream, and it's not going to play out that way. Mm-hmm.
So Chase, how do you define recession? And do you think that term is overused?
I think defining it's really kind of a waste of time. And I think the term is overused, even though I'm guilty very much myself. The only useful way for me to look at it is something bad that happens to the real economy that you know, hurts my portfolio enough, more than normal. So if my portfolio is normally kind of going up and down, 10% drawdown or something, if there's an economic event that would make that more like a 40% drawdown, that's a recession. That's what I need to care about as an investor. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care about what the NBER says. I don't really care if it's the exact 6 months that line up perfectly together to create, you know, two consecutive quarters. I just care about what happens to my portfolio. But mm-hmm. I think if we all had to agree on some sort of definition, to me, the two consecutive quarters makes more sense than anything. We all know what that means. We know what a quarter is. We know what negative growth is. So it's an easy way to do it. You may have saw the rant I went on in my last letter about exactly this, because the NBER, I urge everyone just to go Google the definition they use for recession, because it doesn't mean anything. It's what I refer to as weasel words, you know, words that just leave you tons of wiggle room to make your own meaning out of them. It, mm-hmm. it It's just a worthless view. And I see a lot of people on Twitter saying, oh, it's not two consecutive quarters, you idiots. MBER decides. It's their definition, but they don't have a definition. So I just completely ignore them. I don't care what they think about anything. I don't know. I have no clue why anyone cares what they think about it. And they're not going to tell you until it's over, or, you know, largely over anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're in one now. If we go by that two consecutive quarter definition, and it's obvious, but you still don't see anyone thinking that. I posted on Twitter a few months ago, like, hey, we just had negative growth. And even the people that believe we're going to have a recession, none of them think it's happening right now. That they're all talking, oh, maybe in 2023, we're going to get one, or 2024, you never know. And then, you know, here we are. And all of a sudden, Atlanta Fed has Q2 at negative 2% growth. And we had a bad Q1. They got even revised down. It got revised weaker. Mm-hmm. So if you use that two quarter metric, which to me is the only one we can use because it's the only one that has a real definition, we're in one now, and you see it in so many areas of the economy. But again, everyone's getting fooled by good looking nominal data. But when you have 8% inflation, everything nominal looks great. Like that's just math.
So to that point, where do you see the data pointing for the health of the average American consumer? You know, credit card balances are very high, if not at all-time highs. Do you see a much different story than the Fed does?
I do. But one of the reasons, like, so last year I called for an inflationary boom in 2021. And the pushback I got on that wasn't the inflation part. Everyone loves that story. But the boom part, a lot of people were offended that I thought we could have like really high growth and like real, you know, growth, like not kidding growth. But we did. Like it was an insane year for the economy, for you know, individuals. It's tricky because household balance sheets after the pandemic were truly phenomenal. I mean, everyone's assets were through the roof. Everyone had relatively low debt compared to the size of the economy. Their ability to service that debt was really easy because rates were so low. And I think what the Fed does is they kind of lose sight of the kind of the impact of the rate of change. So if you think about, if you kind of just look at the basic levels of people's assets or people's liabilities, even today, it still doesn't look that bad on the surface. But then when you think about the amount of change the average household has gone through in the last 6 months for how much it costs them to service their debt, their average, you know, where their asset prices are. If you just had, if you have half stocks, half bonds, you've had a worse outcome than you had during the GFC. Mm-hmm. I mean, that drawdown has been huge. And if you look at the data for how exposed the average American is to the market, it's higher than it's ever been. So kind of everyone's riding on the stock market. And that's one of the reasons we had a great 2021, because everyone felt super rich. Well, now all of a sudden you kind of look at your portfolio and you're in a significant drawdown. Your bonds haven't protected you until, you know, the last week, really. So you're kind of feeling poor. Everything you buy has gotten significantly more expensive. So your savings is getting smoked. If you want to buy anything, it's gotten way more expensive. But if you want to finance anything, that's gotten way more expensive because rates have, you know, they've doubled basically in the last 6 months. So just that impact from 6 months ago to now, what that has done to the average person is significant. For one thing, even if it doesn't dramatically change their current consumption patterns, what it does to the way they're planning to spend over the next 6 months versus the last six is a big deal. You know, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people look at this, maybe they're like, you know what, man, we haven't been able to do anything for 2 years because of COVID. So let's have some fun this summer. But then they're kind of looking at their checking account, looking at the 401k, and they're thinking, but after we have some fun this summer, like we got to batten down the hatches for the winter. So I think we're in a recession right now, I think the real pain can really kind of be second half of the year after everyone looks at their personal balance sheet and realizes how much has deteriorated in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, considering all of these asset classes that have really gotten smoked over the past 6 months, let's say, you know, you analyze many different markets, including biotech, cannabis, currencies. So are there any places to, you know, really weather the current storm for those that have been focused, let's say, on metals and commodities?
Yeah, so I think biotech is one of them. I don't think that the pain is over just yet for the just broader equity market, but I think that could be getting closer than a lot of folks think. I think about the time the Fed does pause, that should be a lot for market. Everyone's super bearish. You look at positioning data, sentiment data, it's pretty bad. It should be, but it is. And the market will probably lead the economy out of this the way it kind of fell off the map before anyone even used the word recession. It will probably start bouncing and it won't make any sense. And everyone will think it's another dead cat bounce. It's a bear market rally. All that's going to happen. And it probably will be real at some point before we all think it's going to be real. It'll be painful to buy when you should. And one of the things I want to buy whenever I think we're close to a bottom in broader equities is a lot of biotech. And literally, I'm probably the dumbest person in the world in biotech. It is very complicated stuff. If you just gave me one little company and that does like some super sophisticated cancer stuff, like trust me, if I could spend a year looking into what they do and I'd still have no idea if it was real or a fraud. Like I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the whole space, what I do know is a lot of the companies are trading below cash value. I know that this space has been just absolutely beaten down and it probably should have been. I'm sure there's tons of fake companies in there that don't have promising. There's too many people in the space. So a lot of them had to get, wiped out, bought out and all that kind of stuff. But even a lot of the major players, the kind of the top, call it the top, quartile of companies. If you look at the amount of cash they're generating, and then you look at their share price, the only thing that it makes sense for them to do is dividends, buybacks, and to buy cheap, super cheap competitors, because a lot of the small companies in the space are just radically cheap. So even if they have some decent assets, it makes sense if you're one of the bigger companies to go take them out, go buy them. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll see a lot of mergers and acquisitions in the space, which will help, kind of clean up valuations for the space as a whole. I think you'll see a lot of shareholder yield, which is one of the things that got me into the oil and gas space. Like even if the share price isn't going to go up, they'll pay me along the way and it'll end up being the same for me. It's just a space that from a very top down, kind of viewpoint, I like. You mentioned cannabis. That's one that I've been in for a while and I've done nothing but lose money. And it's just gone straight down since I made the one purchase I made. And it's kind of crazy how if you just chart, say, MSOS, the one that we all kind of think of as like a proxy, if you chart that with something like ARK or pick a, super, like high volatility, frothy growth name or something from the last couple of years, they just chart the same. It's the same mm-hmm. chart. But that's despite the fact that most of those companies, are making money. Like they're actually making money. And this is despite the fact that they can't write off anything on their tax return. So they pay insane tax rates. They can't bank the way, regular companies can because of all the laws. So they have just tremendous headwinds built right into their businesses and they're still making money. Which to me, that's attractive because at some point, a lot of these laws are going to get changed and they'll actually be able to put their money in the bank like the rest of us. They'll be able to borrow money, under 12% or whatever. They'll be able to write off things on their taxes because they're viewed as a legitimate business by the IRS. And whenever they do all that, obviously their margins can explode higher. Mm-hmm. And I like companies that have to learn how to operate in really lean times. Because I know like every dollar they can save, they found it and they've mm-hmm. implemented it because it's the only way they can survive. It's the only way they can make money. So the way I see it, the broad environment for cannabis companies is probably only going to get better. And they already know how to operate when things are terrible. For me, for the investment side of it, I've kind of wanted it to keep going down and I've kind of wanted the legal side of it to not go in their favor. The longer the legal framework is what it is, the better they get, the better they build their brands, the more entrenched they become. And to me, all that's good because eventually, whenever this all gets fully legalized, all of a sudden they have to really compete against each other. Mm-hmm. They have to really compete against, some big names that aren't really in cannabis yet, but big names that will get into cannabis. And then everything is really hard. So if you haven't really built a moat around your brand or some territory, then it gets difficult. So to me, I've been kind of hoping it doesn't get fully legalized just from the investing standpoint until some of those companies kind of really get their feet under them. But even though it's just gone straight down since I bought it, I will buy more. Again, I'll probably buy more whenever I add to this just one tranche. I have one tranche in biotech and one in cannabis. And I'll probably add to both of them at the same time. And it's just going to be whenever I think the Fed's done here, but being our enemy, and you know, the economy's, when the leading indicators look like they're bottoming out and moving higher, mm-hmm. For, you know, for the economy as a whole, that's when I'll kind of add to both of those. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Chase, we've seen the dollar really get a lot stronger here, you know, really over the past year. Are there any factors that are really, let's say, unforeseen that are continuing to push the dollar higher here?
No, not to me. Like, to me, it's all seen. And maybe you could even argue it's all too seen. It's all this obvious. So mm-hmm. if we do get a reversal, first of all, it's going to take something real. It's not going to come out of nowhere. It has to be really good news out of Ukraine, like a full blown, the war is over and we're going to, you know, Russia's going to sell us their gas again, you know, like all that kind of stuff goes away. Mm-hmm. But barring that, I mean, you just have the situation where the Fed's tightening aggressively. The ECB is not. I mean, ECB hasn't really started to tighten yet, and they've already had to say, oh, by the way, even though we're going to tighten, we'll also print money to buy Italian bonds so that they're okay. Like mm-hmm. that's not tightening. You know what I mean? Like, so that situation, and then if natural gas gets bad enough crisis to the point where they're having to shut down heavy industry, what that does to their growth. I mean, you probably saw hopefully everybody saw the chart of the German trade balance going negative, mm-hmm. Which is just unbelievable for Germany. Then that kind of shows you how dire the situation is, you know, on the continent as a whole. So if you start shutting down heavy industry just to keep the lights on and to keep homes warm in the winter, what that does to the kind of the growth differential between the US and Europe is unbelievable. Especially when you consider if a lot of these heavy industries have to shut down in Europe, how much more money the heavy industry that does the same work in the US makes, or just around the world in general makes. The downside potential for the euro in that scenario is bigger than any of us kind of probably realize. And which means, you know, the upside potential for the dollar is, you know, larger than we all realize, which is honestly really scary for the global economy. If you're Turkey or Pakistan or something like that, if you have oil, you know, at 90 or 100, and you have the dollar index at, you know, 110 or 120, I mean, that is just a nightmare scenario. You would have huge, you know, geopolitical and political and financial ramifications or something like that. But at the moment, it's possible because Europe put themselves in a position where they get Russian natural gas or they have to shut down significant chunks of their economy. That's just the reality of it. So, but at this, like I say, at the same time, you know, we can all see that. Everyone's staring at the same thing. We all know it. We can all kind of run a, you know, basic model on that and see how bad it could get. So if it goes the other way, especially after, say we get to parity and then it goes the other way, the war is over and all the gas starts flowing from Russia again, and they started getting a whole bunch more LNG. So all of a sudden Europe has all the gas they could ever need, mm-hmm. and their gas prices, you know, go down 95%. Well, now all of a sudden, like, their growth just comes roaring back, and you get into a situation where the currencies can kind of chill out and go back to normal. Or, you know, when it comes to the yen, if the inflationary pressures drop, the yen can, you know, kind of go back up. Or if they just raise their yield caps up to 1% instead of 25 basis points, you know, the yen can kind of calm down and help this whole situation of capping the dollar. And if you have the euro and the yen kind of doing both of those, you know, good scenarios for each at the same time, that you can have, all of a sudden you can have the dollar falling, you know, far and fast. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, it's tough to see. Mm-hmm.
And considering that, you know, how much of a headwind, let's say, as a relative value metric, the dollar is for metals prices, do you think that we need to see that reversal for the metals to really make a turnaround here? Of course, you know, we're speaking, like I said, on the morning of July 5th, we saw gold break below 1800 today. So what do you think we need to see for the metals to change their attitude, change their direction?
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm seeing gold at down 2%. And for me personally, 1775 is like a really, really big area for gold. Mm-hmm. And at the moment we're about 10 bucks below that. So that's significant. Yes. So to me, gold needs a few things. It needs, and silver needs even more things. But what gold needs is rates to stop going higher. Check. That actually happened. So we're kind of good there. It needs the Fed to at least pause, which I think we're, you know, 2 or 3 months away from that, but it'll happen. And yeah, they need the dollar to stop on this rampage. But nominal yields, real yields, and the dollar, if those can all kind of line up and go the other way, which to me, the macro picture makes it obvious, like that all will happen, especially the first two. The dollar one's a little tougher because Europe is such a dumpster fire at the moment. But once all that happens, to me, like I really think the upside potential for gold once that regime hits is significant. A lot of people have been really frustrated with gold because they thought it was an inflation hedge, and inflation is 8% and gold's going down. They just don't understand. But you know, whenever you look at a chart of what yields did and how fast, and then you look at a chart of what the dollar did and how fast, the fact that gold is even above 1500 to me is awesome. Like I'm very impressed with gold's price action, considering everything that just got thrown at it. When nominal yields are going through the roof and the dollar's going through the roof, that is 75 basis point rate hikes. That's a terrible environment for precious metals, and they've kind of held their own. Obviously they're down, but I would have expected them to be down more in that environment. I own a little bit in my tactical portfolio, which is just getting run over, and I should probably kind of get out and wait a little bit longer. But as far as kind of longer term allocations, to me, this is a solid time to add to those. Mm-hmm.
So Chase, is there anywhere in particular that you're going to be looking at adding once you, let's say, see that turnaround really start to materialize? You know, is it bigger producers? Is it, you know, something in the silver space? What do you like within that realm?
Yeah, for me, like I'm first and foremost a futures trader, so I'll do a lot of it in futures. And then I'm terrible at looking at individual companies, not just biotech, by the way. So I'm the worst at that. But even something in the resource space, like you could point to a nice hole in the ground, like the Mark Twain quote, and I would think it's a good gold mine. So a lot of times I'll use GDX or GDXJ or something like that. But whenever I do delve into individual companies, it's just because somebody way smarter than me told me about it, or I just like to look at the charts. If I see a chart that's doing better than, you know, a lot of the peers or something like that, then I take a harder look. So whenever we get to that point, what I'll probably do is start with futures, and then I'll grab some minor ETFs, and then I'll break apart all the individual names and just go chart by chart and find the ones that I think are just kind of looking the best, have some real breakouts. And for me, a breakout is most important for any of the chartists out there. The if it's breaking above horizontal lines that have a lot of price memory, that's a really big deal. Mm-hmm. And then charting them, you know, take every miner and chart it against GDX. And if it's starting to beat it up and break out against it, like that's a great sign. Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, when we talk about quote unquote inflation hedges, you analyze Bitcoin from time to time, and we've seen a massive slide in that. And as you were saying earlier, if you kind of chart that against some of the big growth names, it's been very similar the way it's behaved. So
exactly.
You know, do you look at Bitcoin as any type of inflation hedge or store of value, or has it really revealed itself as a risk asset that just needs to be traded instead of held as a religion?
Yeah, to me, it's kind of like a 3x QQQ ETF, basically. I mean, at the end of the day, I do think it's revealed itself personally. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a store value, or it's obviously not an inflation hedge. Mm-hmm. That has become very apparent. But this is not to say it's like worthless, especially as a trading vehicle. To me, like at the end of the day, what it is most of all is a great trading vehicle. Mm-hmm. So I still think it's one of those. I bought a little bit at 22K. I'll buy a lot more under 14K, just because I think when the Fed, you know, does an about face, especially if it's not just a pause, but maybe a little cut or something, or, you know, hints at some cuts if things get worse, and all the leading data is telling me, oh, it's getting worse, so they're going to have to do that cut they're talking about. So things like that, then I think it can bounce. I don't think it necessarily is going to go back to the moon. Same with, you know, ARK and things like that. I don't think they're going back to where they came from, but that doesn't mean they can't have vicious, you know, wonderful 50%, you know, moves over 6 weeks or something, because that can happen. Mm-hmm. And I would like to make money when those things happen. So I will use the trading sardine for what it was made for. But but yeah, I do think it's kind of been exposed. But hey, if there are any like crypto enthusiasts out there, like true believers, this is painful, but to me, you got to love this. Like, this is going to push so many of the frauds out of your space. It's going to get rid of everything that didn't have a real case in the future is going away. A lot of the bad actors are going away. So if you're a real crypto person, you kind of have to be happy that all this dead wood's getting trimmed out, so that whenever, you know, things change and you see some green shoots for the space, it's going to be more real on the other end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of to your point that you made about the cannabis space being in such a demanding environment, that only makes the companies that can weather this storm stronger, better at operating, and really reveals what is likely to be the real winners in that space, and only makes that decision on where to invest once that storm is over easier, right?
That's absolutely true. And I think whoever's left standing from crypto after this, you can kind of put a little more trust in them than you could have before. Like, you didn't know who was going to be left standing. Mm-hmm. And we probably still have some dominoes that have to break, some big ones before this is all over. And when that happens, say Tether goes down all the way, and we kind of see, like, okay, what does that really do to the price of everything else? So if you can buy Bitcoin after Tether, you know, is done, and it starts and looks like it's, you know, basing, and then it kind of breaks out of a base, what, you know, whether that's in 3 weeks or 3 years, I don't know, but whenever that kind of happens, then like the amount of trust you can put in the price action from that point forward is just a lot higher than you can now whenever, you know, you're surrounded by landmines.
Yeah, that's a great point. Excellent, Chase. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to kind of wrap up today's conversation. Is there anything you'd like to touch on before we do?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. That was awesome, Tom.
Absolutely, we did. Of course, you have a Substack now since the last time we spoke at pineconemacroresearch.substack.com and pineconemacroresearch.com. Is that right?
Just pineconemacro.com.
Okay, perfect. And share with our audience what your Twitter handle as well.
Yep,
pineconemacro as well, right?
Yeah, at pineconemacro.
Excellent. Chase, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.